Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Pierre Valencin. In everyday use today, speculation usually refers to the strategy of buying an investment in the hope that it will appreciate in value in time. Well, that's all well and good. We have become used to this dimension of the markets. If it weren't for the 2009 financial markets crash, we probably wouldn't worry about the potential losses of investors gambling on speculative schemes. But why do we still rely on speculation at all when a world gives us greater certainty about the future than any before it? Few concepts have had a history as long and varied as speculation. Long before we saw speculation in the financial markets, speculations have been part of the methods of theology, epistemology, science, and philosophy. Speculation has been vain, mere, and divine, and it has given rise to manias, bubbles, crashes, and to new ways of seeing the natural world. A new book by Gail Rogers, Speculation, A Cultural History from Aristotle to AI, traces some of the speculative adjectives and the intellectual histories that they represent. Gail Rogers is chair of English at the University of Pittsburgh, and I'm very happy that he joins me now to discuss the book and his work. Welcome to the show, Gail.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. This has been an incredibly fun book to read, partly because I was expecting at every single page to find tips for gambling and for card games. And
sorry.
The story itself is incredibly rich and surprising. But before we get into any of this, I want to hear a little bit about you and about how you got into this area of research and why speculation, why now, and why you?
So the project started innocently enough, as many projects do, with a curiosity about how and why we plan our futures the way that we do and how we take risks on our futures, how and why some people are willing to take risks in the ways that that they are and that others shy away from that. Of course, I did all of that before this pandemic made us think even more pointedly and differently about risks and risk-taking than we do now. So as I started thinking about this term, I started researching it, and it just kept popping up everywhere. And as I mapped it out, I saw that it mattered a great deal to Geoffrey Chaucer, to Francis Bacon, to Jane Austen, to Adam Smith, to Wall Street traders, to the people who program computers now to trade in high frequencies. And I thought, there's got to be a story here. There has to be a story of how and why this term means so much to so many people. And as I was writing the book, the most common question I would get when someone said, you know, what are you working on? I said, as a book, the history of the concept and practices of speculation, they would say, oh, do you mean the gambling on Wall Street, or do you mean thinking? And my answer was always both. And that's exactly what I was trying to understand myself, is how and why those two things were linked over time, and how and why it was that for centuries, speculation meant contemplation for the most part. And then long about the mid-1700s, it came to mean a mode of gambling that we associate with risky wagers in the future, and how those two became entwined and also spread out to this booming world of genre of speculative fiction, and to a world of thought that we call idle speculation that is still with us, that came from Calvinism, to a whole other modes of thinking that we still live with. And as I kept seeing that everywhere, I just needed to understand what it was about speculation that feels so stigmatized, immoral, insubstantial, and risky, and yet so familiar and so ingrained in everything that we do. When we just buy an insurance policy, we're speculating. We do this every day, and yet we don't really have an understanding of how and why we have done it for centuries. And so that was essentially the questions that I wanted to answer. And it took 2,500 years of history to be able to do that accurately. and I still didn't even get to the card tips.
Well, maybe we'll have some time at the end to go through this or record a special bonus.
That'll be the sequel.
Before we proceed, I want to ask you a little bit about your method and your situation of this inquiry in literature and also in philosophy. I also would like you to talk a little bit about your earlier work, if you can connect the two, because you're a scholar of translation, as far as I understand. So I think it would be interesting to understand how you approach this subject from that perspective.
So my two abiding methodological interests have been, you're right, the history of translation and translation practices, but also the history of concepts and intellectual history. And I think those two are deeply entwined, because I think probably what ties them together is the history of meaning and how meaning changes within and across languages. So this book has both translation and intellectual history in it. Of course, the word speculation passes from Greek to Latin to, we think, Middle Old French to English, and then across many other languages in the course of the book. So I got to do both things that I love doing in the course of writing this book, which was really fun to do. I also got to consult with many people in fields that I don't really know very well, which for scholars like myself who love to be dilettantes of fields that we don't know well, but love to explore and learn about, is actually quite a fun and engaging thing to do. So the book is in part a history of exactly what you said, how meaning changes. But to me, it's also about why meaning changes. Why do we keep looking at this word speculation and deciding it doesn't quite mean what we want it to mean, so we need to make it mean something different? And we do this with words all the time. And that's part of how societies as a whole decide that, come to a consensus that language is not functioning the way that we want it to function. And so we put ideas behind words and make them signify differently. And I think that's a profound part of cultural history, which is the field that I think I'm most closely identified with.
Well, kudos for choosing a word that starts with nearly as much ambiguity as the way you portray speculation does. I mean, I think we can't avoid going through some of the timeline here to arrive at some of the questions and to arrive at some of the uncertainties that you maintain pervade until today. But we're starting with the mirror and the watchtower. I mean, that's a point at which this concept could have gone really in any direction, or at least in one of two quite divergent directions. So I think it would be great to give us a bit of a primer, if you don't mind.
Sure. So essentially, there are two similar but etymologically related but distinct terms operating in Greek and Latin. One is speculatio, is the Latin concept that's associated with it, and the other is speculum. Speculatio is associated with a watchtower. It comes from specula. Watchtower means to look out, look toward the future, so a promontory. Mm-hmm. So you can think of the conceptual associations here with projection, futurity. Speculum, mirror, looking at oneself, introspection, looking at the here and now, looking inward. Those become two very different, very vital concepts in Christian theology, in classical philosophy. Boethius becomes a major figure in championing speculatio as a translation of Aristotle's Theoria, the highest mm-hmm. form of human thought, while a whole host of Christian philosophers champion the mirroring concept of speculum as actually a way of seeing God's work in the material world. So these two are operating in intellectual history, in theological history, ecclesiastical history for centuries. They're distinct, but they also speak to one another a great deal. They overlap in the Middle Ages. They're never fully entwined, certainly, but they certainly inform one another. So by the time they come into English as this word that Geoffrey Chaucer first introduces as speculation, I'm not a scholar of medieval English, so I can't claim to pronounce it perfectly. In the late 1300s, he clearly seems to signal Boethius's version of projection, forward-looking, theoria, looking to the divine. He brings it into English through a translation of Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy, but he definitely has a hint of speculum, the looking inward, the idea of introspection in it as well, too. So it's a fascinating way in which language has transformed over centuries and taken in bits and pieces of writing and study and histories of thought from disparate places in order to sort of accrue and accumulate meaning from various places. And then once it gets let loose into English, it has this sort of potentiality that can go places and attach new things to it.
I'm kind of interested to ask you about a couple of examples of these intertwinings. And one of the things you do throughout the book, which I think is really rich and makes it such a rewarding read, is that with every proposal you make, there's usually a text which somehow manages to both prove your point and the opposite of it at the same time. In Chaucer, for example, you have kind of this opening up of all these meanings. And Chaucer, as you say, has brought so much language into English. He could be credited with so many, you know, introducing so many different words. But I wonder if we could maybe somehow make a jump from this kind of very distinct categories of thought from Aristotle, you know, from poiesis and praxis and theoria, to the kind of blaring. And maybe you could speculate. Sorry, I promised myself I wasn't going to make puns. I wasn't going to use this word, but it's already happened. If you could maybe somehow place already the practice of translation into some of these slippages that are happening.
Sure. So every language creator, especially antiquity, all through the Middle Ages, is a translator of some sort. It's almost necessary. So Chaucer is operating as you said, as a language creator, but also as a translator in that capacity. And right, I mean, it does require some speculative enterprise. We don't know exactly what he was doing. We don't know who exactly he was speaking to, who his distinct reading audience was, what their literacy capacities were, et cetera. So it does require a little bit of piecing together what he was up to when he was creating these new words. But I think, you know, the key part there is to to understand that when any word like this was introduced, it was understood as, you know, bringing with it a whole history of theological and intellectual history behind it. This was not an innocent word to bring into English. Now, Chaucer also brought into English the word trench right around the same time. It did not exactly bring with it a whole history of, look, maybe I'm missing something great here, but I don't think this was something that Aristotle spent a great deal of time meditating upon, right? So
I'll probably give you that one. I'm sure soon enough we'll be reading a book.
Right, I await correction, but right. So but you know, the point is not every word has this sort of history behind it, whereas Boethius had spent a great deal of time and labor specifically translating Aristotle's Theoria into Speculatio, which Chaucer translates into Speculation, right? So there we are. We've got a very, very clear line. Now, you noted something really important that happens throughout the book, which is every time there's an example, there's also some minor variations and sometimes counterexamples. That's the way language operates. It's not like the minute we decide that we want to shift the meaning of a word, that all of a sudden everyone decides the meaning of that word is changed. We see that in the present with the way that a word like queer has changed over time, but has also not changed over time by generation. And you can survey generations about, you know, what's the connotation of this word? What's the affect of this word? And you get varied answers, right? So it's linguistic change and semantic change and connotative change is never just a sort of instant pivot. It takes time. Even when it happens as quickly as it does in the present, imagine how slowly it happened before you had you know, social media to help accelerate the process, right? So, so right, these are slow moving things. But part of what makes that flourish is that, you know, when Chaucer releases this word, we start to see dictionaries try to say, well, what does this mean? What are its equivalents in other languages? Where else can I use it? Where else can I see it? We start to see poets use it. We start to see sonneteers use it. We start to see all sorts of writers use it and say, what can I do with this word? It's sort of a piece of clay that I can shape into something different. The rules are unbound because we don't, you know, there's not yet any kind of policing around the word. There's no Oxford English Dictionary, right? There's no academy that's guarding the boundaries of this word. And so one of the first really tight formations around the word, since what really does make these things stick is just repetition, comes with the printing press when you have an overwhelming majority of printed texts being from the Protestant Revolution and the Calvinists printing text after text that say, idle speculation, idle speculation, idle speculation. Beware idle speculation. Well, then you get an adjective that modifies this word and starts to give it shape and meaning, just in the same way that we see, you know, politicians now just put a modifier in front of a word so that it suddenly the noun itself gets so identified with whatever precedes it that you've, you know, characterized your opponent or whatever it is, right? So idle speculation becomes a phrase that means useless thought. So what used to be for Boethius and for Chaucer, contemplation of a higher divine mind, a higher form of connection with what is out there and beyond from the watchtower, now becomes wasted, empty, vacuous thought. Thought not put into action, not put into deed in the world. And that becomes immensely dangerous, as you can imagine, in the Protestant worldview. And that's kind of what sets into motion the plot of the rest of the book.
And that's incredibly interesting, though. I kind of reading between the lines, I almost saw a precursor to that one adjective. You know, it's not just idle speculation that Calvin comes up with and condemns, but you talked about this kind of detachment of the idea of speculation and its opposition to practice after Chaucer. So we're talking about, you know, 15th century, things kind of become very flexible. And I almost noticed sort of a transition through a moralizing dimension.
Yes.
So, you know, I was thinking a second ago when you were talking about these modifier adjectives, you know, I was thinking about fake news. That might
exactly
be one of the examples they would have come up with. But I'm sort of at a risk of being trivial. Before we have fake news in Donald Trump, we also have a crisis of public confidence in the institutions that takes quite a while before the adjective kind of comes. So while it's quite fun to blame everything on the Reformation, I think there's some kind of, you know, beginner Puritanism happening there before. What I'd like to ask you about now is a little bit how we begin to deal with this by now, by the Reformation, quite well-defined dichotomy of different types of knowledge. So we have, you know, in Boethius, speculation is something that's incredibly useful as a way of acquiring knowledge. But then the Reformation sort of puts a stop to that.
Right.
You know, speculation suddenly is not a way to know God, to create knowledge at all. This is a, you know, maybe a too big a question. How on earth do we deal with all these dichotomies in either the history or even trying to read what's happening in the text that you look at?
Believe me, the present was very much with me as I wrote this book, and as you surely saw, this was part of the 20th century as well, when the research that Einstein was doing, that Max Planck was doing, that Freud was doing, was all called speculative research and was dismissed for not being empirical. What happens is Francis Bacon is plodding along doing his doing his work, and he wants to say, I don't need speculation. Isaac Newton says, I don't need hypotheses. And eventually, Bacon comes to see, And this is in Spratt's History of the Royal Society in London as well. They come to see that there's no way for science to advance, this new science to advance, without speculation. That they can be as dogged as they want to be about practical experimentation only. So practice becomes the antithesis of speculation. So practice meaning what you do in the material world with your hands, not what you do with airy, ethereal thought. But there's no way for it to advance without imaginative projection. You've got to dream up where you think the experiment is going to go. You've got to imagine what the results might be. Otherwise, you're not really doing anything except you're not, to use Bacon's preferred terms, advancing knowledge. The terms that we use for this now in STEM fields are design and implementation. So speculation kind of feeds what now is design, the idea of dreaming up prototypes and proof of concept. That's side of the world. So as much as early science tries to follow at first this Protestant denigration of speculation, and it gets lampooned famously in Gulliver's Travels, where you have the projectors of the Academy at Lagado, and they look completely silly for just being these, you know, what the way that academics are lampooned today for sitting up in an ivory tower and thinking up jargon-filled articles and books about, you know, 15-syllable terms that mean nothing to nobody, right? Yet, time and again, as I try to show throughout the early part of the book, there's the concession that science simply does not advance. Science simply remains static without speculation. And so that tends to be the driving force. And that kind of sets up the way that speculation comes into finance as well, which is where you have Adam Smith, who models capitalism on science and says exactly the same thing, which is, there's really no progress in capitalism without this engine called speculation, which is dreamers saying, I think I've got an idea for how I'm going to make a profit. And here's where I imagine it's going to go. And so we can do all the buying and selling and trading that we want to do, but without a dreamed idea at the start of it, there's nothing.
But I think we're still. Maybe I'm in a moralizing mood today because I'm going to come back to something that again I saw happening a tiny bit earlier. So right after Bacon, you refer to Robert Boyle, another scientist who was extolling the virtues of speculation and practice, who could conspire together, which is, you know, theory practice. We know how it works. But of course, very quickly again he goes into understand that speculations could be productive or unproductive. They could be good or bad. And there's this just moral inevitability. We can't look at this term without requiring another concept by which we judge. By the time it gets to finance, and of course we've spent some time on this because it's what happened for the last 200-300 years. And we time and again need to have some kind of moral reference point.
Yeah, the moral origins come from a classic Protestant-Catholic divide over utility, works versus deeds. That classic debate, Weber gets at this. So this kind of gets to finance really well. Ex post facto validation comes into play. So is this was the speculation worth it? I'll tell you when we have a result, right? Or are we in a bubble? We'll know if and when it crashes or it does not crash, or how high it goes. Are we in a bubble? Well, it's climbing. How high is it going to climb? Well, if it climbs to a certain point, then it's a bubble. If it does not, then it's not, right? So that's kind of been at play in exactly what you pointed out too. So is this speculative element of scientific research valuable? Well, let's do the experiment, and if it works and it proves to provide some sort of social utility or a public good, then it was worth it. And if it fails, this is something that Daniel Defoe railed against all the time, then if it fails, then no, it was not worth it. Well, okay, but how did we know until we did it, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's putting a lot of trust in the scientific
exactly.
research, which we know doesn't always work out to everyone's advantage.
Exactly, but eventually you do develop a common thread, and this is something that other scholars have written about really well. You do develop a common consensus over time that if you can trust the methods and you can trust enough of a public investment in the methods, then failure is worth it. It's the byproducts of failure are okay as long as the methods are sound. So you don't invest in trying to build the Tower of Babel over and over, but if you do invest in things that are sound and seem worthwhile and they don't work out, that's okay as long as the speculation was based on pretty sound principles and just was trying to advance knowledge. So it's an attempt to, and this goes back to what you were getting at, right? It's an attempt to kind of rein in speculation, put some guardrails on speculation by way of what's already worked and what's already been proven. So speculation can only take place within the boundaries of what's already plausible. Now, if you go back to where speculation began with Aristotle, with Boethius, with Chaucer, they would hate this. They would say, no, speculation is to reach the summit of human knowledge. Don't put shackles on it from the start. Otherwise, you're never going to reach the divine, right? Why would you start speculation by saying, I'm going to speculate and I'm going to stop when I reach the city limits? That's a terrible way to speculate.
I would probably insert at this point my own experience of working a little bit in financial services where speculation is the daily currency.
Sure.
The mantra of the bubble is not we'll find out. The mantra of the bubble is this time it's different.
Of course. That's the gamblers. Right.
So actually this is incredibly interesting as a way to go back to the beginnings of all these financial speculations, because you put a lot on Smith, and also, you know, you found in your book, you found America on speculation and financial speculation. And it really strikes me that actually the stakes in both those deployments are incredibly high and mm-hmm. the method is incredibly young. So it's not like, you know, we're not playing the stock market today with
right.
new technologies. We are funding countries. We are issuing war debt for the first time
yep.
ever. We
yep.
are really creating imagination of, you know, things like a better future, really from nowhere. And incredibly quickly, we're spreading these concepts to the wider populace. So maybe take us over the pond and indict your country. We're speaking a day after Independence Day. So maybe you're in a mood to reflect on why speculation and America are so closely linked together.
So you're exactly right. And some historians have written about this in much more detail than I have, but you're exactly right that the speculative schemes on which this country was founded were novel, innovative, and untested. This was not tried and true capitalism built on tested systems. There were all sorts of wild, wild schemes taking place. Some were incredibly successful and some were massive failures. But part of what happened was that the U.S. got associated with a certain type of speculative behavior, both in the minds of Europeans and in the English, but also in our own minds. And so something that feels very familiar, very common to us now, speculative mania, is the idea that speculations happen as a frenzy, that people who are speculating get into a craze and follow this sort of groupthink and crowd-like behavior. That was almost unheard of before 1790, 1788 to 1790. Certainly before that, speculative episodes such as the Dutch tulip bubble, the South Sea bubble in 1720 in England, certainly were condemned as deceitful. The people who participated in them were seen as lemmings jumping off the cliff, but they were not seen as irrational, crazed maniacs. They were seen as individuals who made bad decisions, made silly, deceitful, stupid decisions. But it was only through one of our founding figures, Benjamin Rush, who was Surgeon General of the Continental Army and wrote extensively about mental conditions, wrote an article that got reproduced all over newspapers and journals of the time, in which he classified speculation as a mania. And this is one of the early moments in medical history of, or a really kind of fulcrum moment in thinking about what manias were. And it gets picked up, and very, very persuasively, people begin to label speculative episodes as manias. And so we have the first one in, I believe it's the summer of 1791. I might be off by a year or two, in Philadelphia, with scripomania, as it was called, with scrip, which was subscriptions, basically certificates to pay soldiers who had served in the Continental Army and were owed money. And they would just sell those certificates rather than waiting to get paid. And there became a market in those certificates. And that became an inflationary market, and the value in those skyrocketed. And so rather than just seeing that as yet another bubble or yet another you know, silly financial episode, it became called scripomania. It was called a madness. It was called a frenzy. And ever since then, every episode like that has been called a mania: a railway mania, canal mania, egg mania. We've had a butter mania. And now in the moment, in the present, we have NFT mania, GameStop mania, meme stock mania. You know all this, right?
So thankfully, the NFT mania is all over now.
We've dealt
with that. You were late a little bit.
I think I might have missed my chance on that one. So America gets associated not only with new modes of speculation and the founding of a country, but also with maniacal speculation. So what does every president, I quote quite a number of them, in their State of the Union addresses and their farewell addresses, what do they all say? I'm going to stop this spirit of speculation that has infected our country. So it's a spirit. It's this ethereal thing that passes from mind to mind contagiously, like an epidemic, right? It's no longer just individual judgment, making bad decisions. It's this strangely infectious mental disease. And every one of them suddenly says they're all going to stop it. And when they leave office, they all claim that they stopped it. And yet the next president says, oh, it's back. I've got to stop it. And so so it becomes a really signal American thing that has to be dealt with. And we see it again and again. We see it in the present as a way that we characterize speculations. And one of my real sort of disagreements with that is that I simply don't think it's accurate. I don't think it's accurate at all. I think the GameStop mania, for example, as it's been called, and I could pull up 15 different headlines that have called it a craze and a mania, I think was actually a quite highly coordinated, quite actively and soundly executed plan. I don't see at all what was maniacal about that. I think it was, from all the looks of it, I mean, was it risky? Certainly. But I don't see how anyone, maybe some people, but it does not look to me like irrational, crazed, maniacal behavior. It looks like some people made a plan and followed it. And I think that's the way that actually a lot of these things happen. And so I think it's a moment for us to sort of pause and look back and think about why it is that we habitually call speculations crazes and manias and frenzies, when maybe that's actually not what's happening. And maybe we're just being a little lazy in doing that.
Oh, that's super interesting. Along the trajectory of the book, there's clearly enough evidence of, you know, not all these manias going completely wrong. It's not, you don't present us with a catalogue of one disaster after another. Like, just to kind of go with your own thinking about this, I was drawn in by this description, as you were, as a non-American, but, you know, once you kind of see the America as the idea of this speculative haven in which you go and try out your luck, however poorly founded your ideas are.
Right.
It sort of makes sense. It's part of the mythology of the country. But one thing that you did that was really interesting is you almost brought it into parallel with some of the speculations in the French Revolution. It's not exactly one for one, but there is something there, because France, of course, decompresses from its kind of revolutionary mania reasonably quickly. You know, it's definitely hasn't maintained any of that ethos now. It's not, you know, it's not a crazy place in which people go and speculate to their heart's content. So I wonder whether that's something that we could dwell on for a moment, or maybe think a little bit about how other languages and other literatures deal with those concepts in parallel.
That's a really good one. So one small detail that I found in my research that I loved was in, I believe it was one of the books that Elizabeth Fox Genovese and Eugenia Genovese co-wrote. It could have just been one of the two of them. I can't remember exactly. One of their histories of France had just a small detail that the French used to refer to their Antillean possessions as speculations. But that's what they referred to they referred to the islands themselves as speculations, yeah. Right? So they imagined them the way that a trader might imagine speculative assets. And I thought that was a brilliant way of aligning colonial possessions as fluctuating bubble-like assets. You know, that was accurate because of the ways in which, of course, the material resources that they were extracting from them did fluctuate wildly with wars, revolutions, rebellions, etc. So that's there, and examples like that are there all the time. There's some other, there were some fascinating moments where the term seems to spread, even though speculation comes into English from Romance languages. English seems to give it back to Romance languages after Adam Smith. So Smith's term seems to give it the most powerful sense of risky financial gambling. And yet at the same time, there was a Dutch Jewish writer, Isaac de Pinto, who wrote a much translated theory of credit that was translated into English in the 1760s. I believe he originally wrote it in French, and that talked about speculation a good bit, that might have influenced Smith. So there was a lot of good exchange. It's really tough to kind of get the causality of, you know, who was influencing who. You know, Smith himself had been in Switzerland and France just before writing Wealth of Nations, meeting with the physiocrats. So, you know, if I were a detective and could really get all the way down to who used it first and who influenced who, I would love to. This is one of those great paper trails that will probably never settle completely. It seems to come through Goethe in German, and I'm not 100% sure, but right around
everything does.
I know,
eventually,
right?
Everything traces to Goethe.
Shocker, right? So, but right around the same time as well. So there seems to be kind of a flurry of linguistic exchange right around the same moment in the late 1700s. The really interesting plot line that's beneath all of that is that the sense of speculation that Smith imports into English, that he really wants to accentuate, comes from gambling and smuggling. So he doesn't want simply to have speculation mean high risk, finance or riskier than normal propositions that one might take within capitalism. He really wants it to be a tainted term in his political economy, both because of the risk that he just saw the Air Bank take in his own Scottish context, but also because of what he'd been reading in financial reporting and journalism from 1750s onward. And so he was picking the term up from where it had been used for tea smugglers and others who were trying to, you know, dodge taxes, basically. And so they had been called speculators, and that had been called speculation in rum trading and things like that. So they were gamblers, and they were associated with the itch of gambling or the addiction of gambling. So that that's part of what Adam Smith is trying to bring into the English language, in much the same way that Geoffrey Chaucer was trying to bring in some of the additional senses of speculum that had been developed across the Middle Ages in high theology. So that's kind of one of the beautiful ways that linguistic change can operate, is that when someone has a platform to disseminate a broad sense, a broad connotative sense of a word, and, you know, Wealth of Nations, of course, is this international bestseller, massively influential, they can do a lot with that term. And he uses the term many, many times in Wealth of Nations. They can do a lot with that term and work it over and shape it into multiple forms in ways that someone who used it more routinely perhaps wouldn't have the means or capacities to do.
Yeah, and yet again, we have this kind of moralizing principle emerging while Smith is definitely trying to, you know, have his wicked way with speculation, and he sees it as incredibly useful for his ideas of the economy. He still wants to wag a finger at the wrong type of speculation.
You know, this is one of the headlines for me of writing this book, is that nobody ever uses the term speculation neutrally. This is part of what amazes me about this book, is it's almost like the term justice, right? No one can say justice neutrally, right? Everyone who says it has some idea behind what they mean by it. And yet speculation, which seems far less loaded than justice, it's actually exactly the same. No one means nothing by it.
So is there a relationship with understandings of risk? I mean, you mentioned risk straight to the top of the conversation as one of the things that interested you in looking at this intellectual history. And I come back to this word because we have, you know, science now about the public understanding of risk. We have actuarial science. Right. We don't necessarily talk about speculation when it comes to insurance, even though it's clear from early work and the things that you cite that those concepts are really close together. But we have preset attitudes towards risk. And I think that to a certain extent really has trained us to be able to accept certain types of risk without necessarily questioning those kind of frictions that maybe the word speculation, while it potentially means something very similar, has never really shed. I was interested in looking at the explosion of the financial market speculation in the US with the advent of the ticker tape, and particularly, again, thinking about risk, thinking about ways in which financial instruments themselves are created particularly to introduce risk, to introduce speculation. So I'm not just talking about, you know, gambling on a stock market. I'm talking about early forms of derivatives and financial arrangements that actually make the world more complicated with the idea of extracting gain.
That's a great question. So one of the most common introductions to risk that people have is when they get a job and they get a retirement account. And you go and you sit down with the retirement advisor, and you choose your retirement portfolio based on your risk tolerance. And they've got that little wheel or that little semicircle that says, what's your risk tolerance? Aggressive, moderate, or conservative, right? And you're exactly right. People are okay with using the term risk there, Now, what if that instead of saying, you know, risk tolerance, what if it said speculator? What kind of speculator are you? People would think very differently about that because no one wants to be a speculator because, as you have stressed here, it's a moral judgment, right? It's not a neutral term. You would feel like you're being judged. Your character is being judged there rather than just, how do you want to invest? It's up to you, right? But the fact is that speculation and risk as concepts have been deeply entwined, especially in the last 160, 180 years in all sorts of ways, in stock markets, in thinking about technology, machine technologies, nuclear technologies, in thinking about futurism, future technologies, in artificial intelligence technologies. The two have become speculation. The risk has become its twin concept more than any other concept. That was not present 2,000 years ago, 1,000 years ago, etc. So that's been the major turning point for it, that its deep imbrication with capitalism has changed. And so John Levy's book, Freaks of Fortune, is probably the best history of this, the history of risk in modern capitalism. And he's got some great examples of exactly what you say, how the explosion of trading in the Chicago Board of Trade in the 1860s, 1870s with futures contract, there's some incredible statistic where something, you know, trillions of contracts, trillions of bushels of wheat are traded, and yet only a few billion are ever actually delivered, right? So it's all about the future being bought, sold, packaged, and profited upon by derivatives products for which the material object, which, to kind of add another layer of irony to this, is a life-sustaining grain, is a secondary or tertiary consideration. That has fundamentally changed things, especially when the derivatives are so complex that the modern person is not even sure what it is that's being traded. I mean, you have derivatives that are just completely unintelligible to the layman, so that you're not, and they're being traded by algorithms, so that, you know, if you were to sit someone down and say, here are some major trades that are shaping the stock market, which your retirement portfolio depends on, they're, you know, quite discomforted by that. That, of course, is a major instance of what speculation is and what it means now. And for a good reason, that gives a lot of people anxiety.
Yeah, I'm trying to think about my times in financial services where actually speculation was the nice bit, you know, like being able to sell the dream was the fun bit. The actual performance of the contract was always left somewhere else. And of course exactly. We have this kind of slightly strange and not necessarily correct readings of, say, the 2008 financial crisis, in which infamously even the traders didn't understand what they were trading. I mean, that's a very simplistic reading of a cultural history of an event that had multiple inputs into it. And
sure. Well, part of what fascinated me, though, in writing the book was this arc where we go from speculation as the peak and the summit of human mental aspirations and loftiness in Boethius to what some would argue is not human at all, which is computational machine-driven trading. I make the argument that's not quite accurate. There's still human inputs. There's still human programming. There's still, right? So we don't want to say it's entirely inhuman, but it's certainly not fully human. So there's a really interesting arc there that we need to trace over history, and we need to think about what it means for us, to think about the ways in which speculation, at least in quantity, is largely taking place without our minds. Yet at the same time, there's also 7 billion of us who are all speculating in this other way, which is thinking, dreaming, contemplating, purchasing insurance policies that protect us against future unknowns, taking risks, hedging, doing all sorts of other speculating. So how that quantity measures up in unquantifiable ways against what's happening in flash trading is something that this is the sort of speculative ending of my book, which is I just don't know what to do with that. And where this might appeal to you is given your own history is like where this book really started, where I got this from, was in Tom McCarthy's Remainder, where the unnamed narrator wins this lump sum. He goes and invests it, and he wants to understand how speculation works. And he goes to a financial advisor and he says, I want to put all my money in the stock market. And he says, well, what makes the stock market stay up? And the advisor says, well, all these people think that assets have value. And he says, well, what if they stop thinking it? Oh, well, then they go down. And he says, well, they go down, we want to lose all my money. And he says, well, yeah, but we don't think that'll happen. So that's basically it. It's collective imagination projects things upwards and sustains them. But what is that? It's this ethereal, airy force that Calvin condemned is actually what's suspending the Dow Jones Industrial Average up there at 34,000 or whatever it is. That's exactly it. So it is working. It's not at all idle, but that's there it is, right? And so that was sort of the fundamental irony that I thought I needed to start digging into.
If I was going to write this book, I probably would have also started with a Tom McCarthy novel, but a different one. And you have a blurb at the back of your book from Tom, and he's there cited as the author of Saturn Island. And Saturn Yes. Island is, at risk of completely taking us away from your topic, Saturn Island Yes. is, in my memory, a novel in which something like a Quango or an advertising agency or this kind of weird shadowy advisory mm-hmm. organization, the company tries to advise the world or a government on the implementation of the CubeSassen project. The CubeSassen project is referred yep. to dozens of times in the book without any explanation whatsoever. It's clear that you know Tim McCarthy, but I happen to know the CubeSassen, so I know what the project is. Oh. And I can attest.
I know the artist,
and I've engaged oh. with the project. I've spent 3 days in Jersey trying to look at sketches of the project and figure out what's going on.
Oh, great! I've never seen the project. That's great.
It's speculative. I can tell you, it is more Good. Speculative than extant for sure. So, I think you took a great starting point. Okay, so one of the things that you do throughout the book, which I think is beautifully interesting, between all these examples of Smith and all these kind of technical texts and capitalism and American projecting and prospecting, is the novel. We definitely have Swift, who has a go at capitalism and prospecting, but we also have Jane Austen, and we have a whole chapter that looks at a rather unexpected history of women speculators. So, I mean, we have, of course, this kind of introduction in which women are not allowed to do one thing after another, but actually quite a lot of very, very surprisingly clear approaches to both the market and speculative freedoms.
So one of the great discoveries for me in this was the ways in which speculation operated as a keyword for communities. In this case, communities of women investors or women speculators, depending on how you read mm-hmm. them. this is one of the great debates. And women novelists, women poets, and in the present, women investors were limited in certain ways and yet had great freedom in other ways. So what used to be called spinsters had degrees of autonomy as investors, since they did not have husbands who controlled their money or their decision making, that would probably surprise most current onlookers, and made some quite risky bets. And then other times, I cite this throughout the book, I discover these diarists from the 1800s who are constantly frustrated that their husbands won't let them invest in risky silver mines in Peru or whatever it is, right? But probably the most compelling figures that that I think people should know more about are the Claflin sisters, who opened the first woman-owned brokerage on Wall Street in 1870. And why they're interesting is not just for what they did in history, but also the way that they get characterized. What were they called? They were called witches. Where did they come from? What was their history? Well, they were, and there's no two ways about this, they were frauds. Their history was that they had traveled around the Midwest doing magnetic healing, which of course was fake, and they would dupe people and pretend to, and they were clairvoyants. Their father was a snake oil salesman and medical quack, et cetera. So, they came by this quite naturally, but they were very successful. But they took this to Wall Street. Now, why was this a natural transition for them? Because Wall Street at the time, it was entirely normal to read horoscopes for financial advice. The idea that one would read masses of data from corporate quarterly earnings reports, or that you would consult PE ratios and things like that, is very new, very common. This was not at all common in the late 1800s, or if it was, it was common only to a certain class, and investment itself was limited to a very, very small percentage of Americans too. So they were speaking to a very small crowd, and the crowd that saw them and saw their successes immediately labeled them as some sort of, they were called the bewitching brokers in a famous cartoon from Harper's. But all the while, you have these novelists such as Jane Austen has this really amazing scene in Mansfield Park, where characters are trying to sort out both marriage plots and speculative financing of rehabilitating a house and their futures around a card game, which developed in the early 1800s called speculation. It was a version of whist, which was a kind of a leisure class card game. And it was a high risk card game where you had to sort of guess what your opponent was holding, and you had to make really dramatic plays. I'm kind of determined to get some people together and learn how to play this game and reinitiate it. So they play speculation. It was this game that Austen loved herself. And then you see episodes such as George Eliot. You have characters who constantly are associate gambling and marriage plots, right? Mm. Or the idea that we see this in Kate Chopin as well, where the idea that marriage is a speculation of some type, or the formulation of the marriage plot in a novel is a gamble of some type. The language gets bound up together. They work in the language of manias. They work in the language of fevers, of crazes. They have their characters have fevers and go crazy, etc. All of this gets bound together in a way that, I kind of trace this out in the book, that you see that this is something that's being passed along as a tradition within women novelists, especially across the 1800s. And to my mind, what this leads up to is the ways in which speculation is also operating now, as we see in communities that are trying to say, let's reclaim the term speculation. Mm-hmm. So speculation, when we think of it, we think of the domination of finance capitalism. Why? Why can't speculation mean dreaming up other worlds than the one that, dominant multinational global capitalism has created? The critic Fred Moten has talked about speculative practice. Saidiya Hartman has just written a very, very fascinating book that she calls a speculative history. Amy Bong has written a book about migrants and speculative histories that they are creating and writing. So why not start from the edges, minoritized communities, communities of color, oppressed communities, and understand speculation as beginning there rather than speculation, is beginning from the centers of power and the centers of flows of capital and of finance. And if we start there and try to flip or invert what speculation is or what speculation can do, and try to reclaim the imaginative power and the imaginative force of it, we actually kind of get back to where we started with Boethius and Aristotle, and not to the machine-driven algorithm speculation that continues the further reach of multinational capitalism, which is what they're trying to kind of resist as a homogenizing force.
Yeah, and one of the nice vignettes in the book is this idea that by the early 20th century, speculation becomes a tool of feminist strategies of emancipation. So there is precedent for this kind of thinking. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Gil. This is the book has been a lot of
fun.
Thank you. I've been very well entertained, despite the lack of card trick tips in our conversation. I want to ask you before I let you go about your future research plans. Where is this going? You've got your West performances and that research project, but presumably you're also going to be treating us to a new book.
Well, a new book is will take some time. I still have more that I want to say about risk and risk assessment, actually. So I finished this book the very, very end of it amid the pandemic. And as you can imagine, I realized I had much more to say about risk assessment and the ways in which risk is imagined than I could possibly fit in this book. So this book, risk becomes a major player in it in the final two and a half chapters. But I've got a lot more that I want to say, and I've started to learn stats, which is something that I think all of us have started to learn in some way, whether we like it or not. And so that's kind of where I'm headed next right now. I don't know how large this is. I'm writing some shorter things on it right now. So that's part of what I want to try to figure out first is what else I want to say about risk that's an outgrowth of this work, but it'll be distinct from it, certainly. These are just some pieces that I want to try to wrap my head around before I fully leave behind the world of speculative risk. And then where I will go from there as Asquith said once, is a remote and speculative future.
I was expecting a pun to finish our conversation, but you wrapped it up incredibly eloquently. Gail, thank you so much for joining
thank
me.
Thank you for having me. This was really wonderful. I appreciate it.
Speculation, A Cultural History from Aristotle to AI by Gail Rogers is published by Columbia University Press. I'm Pierre Davancet, and the editor is Marshall Poe. Thank you for listening, and join us next time.